Hey everybody, James Beckett here, and I'd just like to thank you all so much for joining us on this inaugural episode of the Kick the Beckett podcast. If you don't know me, I'm a freelance critic, a writer for sites like Anime News Network. I have a blog that's also called Kick the Beckett, and the whole goal of this podcast is going to be to take a deep dive that celebrates the best and sometimes the worst that pop culture has to offer. Movies, video games, television, the works. The miniseries we're launching with is called Experiencing Evangelion. As of June 21st, 2019, Netflix will have released both the anime, Neon Genesis Evangelion, as well as its two accompanying films, Death and The End of Evangelion, which marks the first time these properties have been made legally available in the West for years. This first episode zero is a conversation that I recorded with my co-host Doc, aka The Subtle Doctor, as kind of a preview of our overall thoughts and feelings of the show. After that, each episode of the miniseries is going to be a hybrid podcast commentary track that will cover 4 to 5 episodes of the anime at a time, as well as an individual commentary track being recorded for each of the movies. The idea is going to be that you can listen to the episodes of the podcast on their own like you would any other podcast, or if you want, you can sync the podcast up to the Netflix version of the series, and you can watch along with us in real time like a DVD commentary track. Now, Doc and I's conversation was actually recorded a couple of days before Netflix launched the series on June 21st, which means there are a couple of instances where we speculate about the performers being cast as the characters for the new dub, or the translation that the show is going with, that have obviously had a lot more developments over the past couple of days, and we'll be discussing those in a lot more detail once we get to the commentary tracks in future episodes. Thank you so much again for joining us, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe, leave us your feedback on whichever podcasting services you use, and if you want further updates from me or news about future episodes of the show, follow me on Twitter, @KickTheBeckett. And now, here is episode zero of Experiencing Evangelion.
This is man's ultimate fighting machine, the synthetic life form known as Evangelion, Unit 1. Built here in secret, it is mankind's last hope.
So first things first, I'm anticipating that a lot of you guys listening to this might not necessarily be super familiar with Evangelion. It's, you know, been in the conversation forever, but it's been out of print in the West for many, many years now. It's been almost impossible to get on DVD for a reasonable price. And, you know, if you haven't been illegally pirating it, pretty much the only normal means for people to experience the franchise has been through the rebuild movies. But we're here talking about the original television series first and foremost. And Doc, before we dive into the specifics of the show and kind of our thoughts and feelings on the whole thing, I just want to ask, when was the first time you saw Evangelion and what kind of impact did it have on you?
I think I saw it first in 2003 or 2004. I was a sophomore in college, which I started in 02. So it would have been either 03 or 04. And a friend of my brother's had gotten some bootleg Evangelion DVDs off of eBay. So I would go on to buy the series legally much later. But I recorded those to VHS tape. And this will be important for something I share in a moment. But I watched those DVDs with my brother for the first time. And I remember thinking, like, whoa, wow.
you went full Keanu Reeves.
Totally. I was disoriented. I was flabbergasted, bamboozled, caught off guard. I was my heart was kicked a little bit. But As a 19-year-old, my own kind of critical chops and ability to articulate why things were affecting me in the way that they were was pretty much pretty nil. It was much lower than my still very low ability to do that now. It's even worse, which is bad. But I still felt like, wow, this is a thing that I like. It made me feel these deep things, even though I don't know how to express them. And So I like I said, I took those VHS recordings from the DVD, and this was the dub, by the way, that I watched, the English dub. So I took that back to college with me, and I watched it like almost immediately after I had seen it, the TV series, with my best friend, and he was like, yo, what the f-? Can I swear on this podcast? I didn't forget to ask that beforehand.
Well, you know, I feel like at least one like full clear WTF is pretty warranted for Evangelion. That's like one of the most common fundamental reactions to that show for reasons that we'll be diving into very deeply as we cover the series proper. But you first saw it in college.
That's right. I first saw it in college and to pick up. My reaction to it will change because, again, first time I saw it was wowed. The second time I watched it with my friend, he was very down on it. He was like, look, what happened? Like, it's incomprehensible. They can't get away with this. They have swindled you. They have swindled me. Like, I have no idea what happened. This is like just nonsensical and it's bad. What the hell, you know, is happening? And then I was like, you know what? You're right. Because I can't understand it, it's bad. So objectively.
Your reaction, did that include the theatrical end of Evangelion movies, or was that just the 26 episodes of the anime?
It was just the anime. I would see the end of Eva movie a little bit later, but that's the only time I've seen it. So I actually haven't seen that film in like almost 20 years.
Oh man. that makes me so excited for what's to come. That movie is a lot, but no, you're right. Yeah. The original series, it is infamous, I think you could say, for having an ending that doesn't necessarily tie up all of the plot's loose ends. We start off with, you know, this kid, Shinji Ikari, comes to Tokyo 3. The whole world is kind of screwed over by Apocalypse, and it's just starting to rebuild. And, you know, over 26 episodes, the show, you know, tells this incredibly compelling, you know, dramatic, like you said, kind of heartbreaking story about these kids that are forced to pilot these giant robots to fight these monsters. And then in that final stretch, especially in those last two episodes, you know, a lot of people feel like the story is not wrapped up in a traditional or a traditionally satisfying way. Once you got around to it that second time, that was kind of how you felt about the show as a whole.
Yes, that's right. I was wrong about it is a neat way of summing it up. I was dumb. I was a kid. I was, again, very much like, because I can't understand it on my own, then it's bad. So, but yeah, I mean, it's not to downplay anything that you said. It is a very complex show. It does tie up in an unconventional way, but that is what's really special about it. And I will talk about, of course, the ending in great detail as we view it. But I think it's the ending of the TV show is incredibly special and important to me. So this brings me to, of course, you may be thinking, wait a minute, how did you get there? That's because over the years, I kind of fell out of anime fandom a little bit after college as I went into grad school. And then in the, it was in 2009 is when I really plugged back in and started to invest in anime as a medium. And by that, I mean, like, get really involved in the community, start learning about people who created it and kind of who they were and what they did, tried to watch like the seminal works of anime, and rather than like relying on, you know, like a show's key art to determine whether or not I should watch it. I would hear on like podcasts like Anime News Network and Anime World Order, I would hear them talk and have guests on to talk about Evangelion, and the way they talked about it was so deeply fascinating to me that I just began to wonder as I heard more and more, is there something I'm missing? Like, this sounds so deep and complex and multifaceted and about these these things I've been learning about in grad school, philosophy, psychology, like, you know, it sounds like something I'd love to sink my teeth into, but, you know, was I just wrong about it? And so a couple of years later in, I think, 2012, you know, right around the time it went out of print, like, I was able to get one of those super cheap box sets that Right Stuff was selling. I think that for a while they were selling like the Perfect Collection or something for $20.
Oh, yeah, yeah, like the Platinum Collection.
The Platinum Collection it was, yes. So I picked that up, and it's like, okay, gonna rewatch this. And I think you can still find on my old anime blog my reaction to it. I was very much blown away by it. You know, at that time, I had been through, like I said, I'd gotten several degrees. I had started a family. I had lost people close to me. You know, I had become a father. All this life, I had been diagnosed with anxiety disorder, depression. I would later come to find out as well. OCD, mental health stuff. So all this life experience that really helped me identify with and just kind of connect with the characters and the tone and the messages of the show way more. And I got so much more out of it. And I hope this is not coming off as like, you have to be old and wise to understand Evangelion, because this is not what I'm trying to say at all. I'm saying I was silly and wrong. And I have come around, and I think like that life experience is what helped me kind of plug into it and want to give it a chance, along with the like the passionate and intelligent discourse about Evangelion that I heard.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think that your valuing of that life experience is off base at all. I mean, it's really interesting because it's such a different, but also not that different experience compared to, you know, my time with the show. Because when I first saw Evangelion, I'll never forget it, actually. It was like, it's like one of those anecdotes that's burned into my memory. I was about 12 or 13, and you know, I was right around the time where my taste in anime was growing beyond just whatever Toonami was showing. The local library was constantly kind of stocking up on whatever anime DVDs they could get. And so I was always checking out new shows, and my taste were expanding, and I was really getting into the medium. And my father took all of us on a road trip to Las Vegas. And my dad's always been a tech nut. And so for that trip, he actually got, and this will seem quaint now, but at the time it seemed completely mind-blowing, he got those portable DVD players that you can like strap to the back of a seat. So when you're on a road trip, you can just pop in a movie and watch it like you're in an airplane. And we were super excited for it. And my dad gave my siblings and I each like $40 and said, run into the Best Buy, grab whichever DVDs you want, and that'll be what you get to watch on this road trip. And you know, I've always been the kind of kid that whenever we're at the mall or whenever we're kind of, you know, shopping around, I immediately just sort of window shop in the DVD section just to see what's out.
Yes.
And that Platinum Collection, you know, that Neon Genesis Evangelion Platinum Collection, you know, I'd been eyeing that for a while, mostly because I thought the girl with the red hair on the cover was really cute. But, you know, what can I say? Something about it seemed...
And you've stumbled on the enduring legacy of the show.
I did. Well, because, you know, at the time, I wasn't necessarily trolling forums. I wasn't really involved in any kind of fandom discourse. My only experience with anime was whatever I personally could get a hold of and whatever my friends could get a hold of. But I really had no idea what the show was outside of just being vaguely aware that it was a popular show. You know, I would see some issues of New Type USA and the characters would be on there. And so I knew that it was like a thing, but I had no idea really what it was about other than that it had giant robots. And I didn't really know about any of the controversy or any of the kind of more mature and complex themes that it, you know, eventually deals with. I just thought it had cute girls and giant robots. And so I picked it up and I started watching it on that road trip. And I got so engrossed that during that trip, you know, me being a teenager and it being a Las Vegas trip, I couldn't really like go hang out in the casinos. And so I brought that portable DVD player into the hotel room and I just plowed through almost all of Evangelion over the course of like a single weekend. That sort of inexplicable quality to the show, that you know, WTF factor, that I've never seen anything like this, it's unconventional, it's weird. You know, that's what immediately drew me into it. But I will also say, at the time, being as young as I was, there were definitely aspects of the show I was really able to sort of viscerally and emotionally appreciate. And there are many aspects of the show that I've, like you said, only really been able to fully contend with and fully have perspective on with the passage of time. It's sort of funny. There are aspects of the show that when I was 13, I thought made it super deep and super interesting and, you know, unlike anything anyone had ever made before. And now that I'm older, those parts of the show, which we'll talk about, the kind of weird, crazy allusions to, you know, Judeo-Christian mythology. To me now, that stuff is kind of the least interesting part of the show. That stuff is, you know, it's just kind of, it's there. But at the time when I was 13, you know, I was running around pretty much telling anyone I could, like, oh, you gotta check out this show, Evangelion. It has all this deep religious symbolism that, like, I don't even understand because I'm 13. And I kind of wish I could go back in time and be like, look, kid, maybe you're looking at the wrong things. Or maybe not. You know, we'll talk about that. But let me ask you, Doc, when you finally had that realization or that kind of that reaction to the show that sort of cemented it as a title that you really appreciated and that you really got a lot out of, what would you say was your main kind of takeaway?
Well, as a caveat to what I'm about to say, 13-year-old you and 19-year-old me, the show did get its hooks in us and hopefully will get its hooks in other people, even though we didn't sort of understand much of it, you know. And so there are, I think the show's imagery is like so iconic that's a way that it can connect with people. And I think it is, for some reason, I don't know, maybe it's more kind of acceptable. Maybe it's always been acceptable and it just wasn't something that I was thinking about, but like to enjoy a series that way, you know, to just really connect with the mood and the visuals and not care as much about every little thing and looking up every reference and like having like a coherent, like, okay, this is the philosophy of the show or whatever. I think all that's like super valuable and you're able to do it with Ava, but like, I just think that there's so many ways that the show can grab you. And they're all valid, you know, even if it's like the characters, you know, like you said, like, I mean, this is like one of the only anime that I can think of who's like the characters have just endured for so long. And I think even without the rebuild movies, like the merch would still be like, they would still be churning out new Asuka Rei figures, right? Because those characters, their designs, their and everything about them are so, I mean, I use the word iconic. That's the only word I can think of to describe them.
No,
as well.
I absolutely agree. You know, it's really funny that you say that you mentioned the just the raw power of the show's visuals, because I totally agree. I think, and we're going to, you know, it's going to be something that I'm going to have to be careful of as we go through those commentary episodes, because I know for a fact that every other shot, I'm going to be like, iconic shot. Like, that's the shot that has been, that has just been cemented in the anime visual lexicon forever. And it's interesting because that actually, there's a tweet that I read just the other day that I think perfectly described the way that Evangelion got its hooks into so many people. But they described Evangelion as, you know, imagine if something as bizarre and visceral and raw and completely indecipherable to some as Twin Peaks The Return, but if it had the cultural impact of a Star Wars movie, you know, imagine if literally every person in America binge watched Twin Peaks: The Return at the same time and just imagined what that would do to like the cultural conversation.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what Evangelion did. And that's what I think it will do again once it's available on Netflix, is that it, you know, it has that power to just hook you with its characters and with its story. And it occasionally uses that power to be, I think maybe a good word for it is challenging in mm-hmm. ways that fans might not necessarily be used to. Although, I mean, so many shows have aped the Evangelion formula that I'm also wondering if maybe it'll seem like passé to new viewers. It's almost a cliche to say this in this day and age, but it really is true that, I mean, Evangelion completely changed anime forever. Like, there's pre- and post-Evangelion.
Totally, and totally. And like you, and just to cut it really quick, like you talk about Dragon Ball, like Dragon Ball, you know, there's a lot of Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball is still going. And like people might think, oh, Gundam had this. There will always be Gundam. There will always be new Gundam happening to like stir up the fan base and get them to. But for a while, there was just this one TV show and the movie. And it still fueled everyone's imagination for decades.
You know, for those of you that maybe don't have as much of a relationship with Evangelion, you didn't get to watch it when it was on DVD, or you've only gotten to see like the new rebuild films, and maybe you're not so familiar with the show itself. It's really, really hard to overstate just how much of an impact the show had. Like, it to the point where people don't even realize that they've been impacted by it. You know, they'll see shows that are directly or indirectly taking their cue from this series, and, you know, they will love them or hate them or have whatever opinion they want to have about them, but they might not even know that, like, this is specifically trying to play off of something that Evangelion did, or that Evangelion played off of from an older series, and it's kind of the cycle that's recurring over and over. And so something I'm really interested to see is just what people are going to make of the show and whether it's going to have the same kind of impact for people that have grown up in a world with, you know, Raxaphon or Darling in the Franxx or, you know, Monica Magica.
Absolutely. And so I should just now directly answer the question and not, you know, continue to just throw caveats to my answer out there. Sorry about
Please.
That.
But, caveats are welcome. This is the caveat corner as far as I'm concerned.
So, well, I mean, for you, that will be accommodating to me. You pretty much have to make it so when I'm on the show. But so what is my main takeaway? From the TV show, I think it would be... Oh, it would be the depiction of an understanding by the creators to depict like various psychoses and mental health issues in a way that deeply resonates with me and I think will really resonate with a lot of people. And it will be a hard watch for a lot of people. And it's partly why I don't watch, like rewatch the show as, you know, as highly as I think of it. I mean, for me, it's like a top three all time favorite anime. But I don't revisit it a lot because that stuff is so raw and so difficult, despite, I think, the ending of the TV show being this really beautiful way to get to self-acceptance. Think it
you
really...
know, I'm so happy you said that. You know, this is, and we'll be talking about this quite a bit, especially when we get to the ending, but, you know, it's almost become kind of like a meme that, especially the movie, The End of Evangelion, not just like the end of the show, but like the specific film, The End of Evangelion.
Right.
It's almost become a meme that it's like this unbearably depressing, nihilistic, bleak, upsetting work of art. And it definitely has shades of all those emotions. You know, yes. Like you said, it's not an easy sit. It definitely goes out of its way to kind of push people out of their comfort zones. But, you know, one of the hills that I am going to be willing to die on is that Evangelion is ultimately, like you said, an incredibly hopeful show. It is an optimistic series. You know, it's not out to make people feel bad. It's not out to make people feel depressed themselves. But
I agree.
I think you absolutely are right when you say it empathizes,
yes,
with those feelings of depression, loneliness, you know, that difficulty connecting with other people. It empathizes with those emotions so deeply, and I think so unabashedly, that you're right. A lot of people might look at that and go, oh, this is too depressing, this is too sad, this is too bleak. But yeah, no, I'm actually really excited for people to see the series in its full context, finally, after all these years, because my hope is that, you know, people will have a very similar takeaway to what you had, which is, you know, this is a show that is about hope. Mm-hmm. And also about, you know, giant robots punching big old monsters in the face, which it's easy to forget sometimes. Like, you know, we've spent the last half hour talking about these psychological, emotional underpinnings to the show. But
the highfalutin.
The highfalutin part of it.
Stuff, yeah.
But, you know, what people might be surprised, you know, especially if they've never seen the movies or anything before, you know, for a good portion of its runtime, Evangelion is just, it's a kick-ass anime about giant robots punching monsters in the face. And it takes a while to get to those deeper themes and ideas. It definitely makes sure to entertain as much as it engages with less pleasant ideas. You know, speaking of the kind of meme that Evangelion has managed to become over the years.
Yep.
One of the biggest, I think, memes to come out of Evangelion is, you know, getting the robot.
Don't
Shinji.
Say it. You said it.
I know. No. I know. It's one of those things where I've met people. I've met, you know, I at the school that I teach at, I run an anime club, you know, and I have a lot of young up and coming anime fans. You know, God help them. it's getting more and more crazy by the day to belong to this wonderful and occasionally wild fandom. You know, I've heard, like, they've yelled at each other, like, get in the robot. And none of them have ever seen Evangelion. They barely even know what it is. The Rebuild movies are out there, but, you know, 13-year-olds aren't, like, going out of the way to buy quasi-remakes to 20-year-old shows that they've never seen.
Yeah.
And so the idea of Shinji, you know, the main character of Evangelion, becoming this sort of iconic symbol of, I don't know, what would you, cowardice?
Yeah.
Impotence. impotence. A lot of less than savory types would say he's kind of an anti-masculine figure. He does not slot neatly into what a lot of people would describe as traditionally masculine or heroic features.
No.
Which, you know, I've definitely heard a lot of people use that argument to be super gross. But, you know, it's one of those things where it also doesn't necessarily become a meme without having this underlying foundation of, I mean, if not truth, of, you know, a reference point that everyone can kind of agree on. And so, you know, let me ask, and I'm guessing, you know, your opinion probably shifted over time, but of Shinji Ikari, the, you know, ever conflicted, ever tortured, ever hesitant hero of Evangelion, was there ever a time where you just were not on board with him as a main character, or was he one of the aspects of the show that kind of always clicked with you?
Oh, yeah. In the, you know, my early watches of the show, you know, and I think, look, that may make you mad by saying this, because, and I know that there are a lot of fans of the original dub out there, and I do like that dub, in a lot of its aspects, but, I don't think that the character and that kind of image, like the English voice, it just exacerbates all those qualities that annoy people about him.
So you're referring to Spike Spencer, the original English voice actor for Shinji?
I am. Yes. Yes. And, you know, this is not me saying, oh, I know who should have played him and done a better job. But I definitely remember thinking, as I watched it the first time, like, not the whole way through the show, but just at different points, like, God, you're just annoying. Like, God. And you know, at times he would definitely grate on me, but like going back, right, and like watching it the last couple times, and watching it those times in Japanese, God, I sound like such a fucking subs elitist. Oh, excuse me. I sound like such a darn subs elitist, which I'm not.
Hey, subs versus dubs, man. You got to pick a side. You got to pick a side, man.
But let's the last couple times I watched it, I'm totally come around on. I mean, I think the characterization is beautiful. Like, and just because of how. I mean, I think everybody can see like the worst parts of their, but only the worst is probably wrong. But like, yeah, maybe even like the worst parts or are parts that they just don't like, we'll say, of themselves in Shinji. And I definitely see a lot of my own bad tendencies there. And we're all cowards sometimes. We're all impotent. Like, but you know, if you watch the show in its full context, like he also has these incredibly heroic moments, moments where he rises to the challenge, but life will still continue to beat him down nonetheless. But I think it's wonderful. And I think it's he is the reason that the show works, like because of his like his amazing journey from where he begins to kind of how he again in the end of the TV show anyway, I feel accepts himself. I feel that's such a beautiful journey and it's so earned because like we talked about his hangups, his deficiencies, his issues are on full display and they are deeply explored and they're not copped out on.
Yeah, no, he's, I mean, I think at the end of the day, what bothers people about Shinji, not to oversimplify things, but I think what bothers a lot of people about Shinji is that, you know, he's a 14-year-old boy.
Yes.
But he actually thinks and acts and reacts like a 14-year-old would, I think, mm-hmm. or like many 14-year-olds would. He's not especially skilled at being a hero in the ways that you might expect an anime hero to be.
Especially for the genre, right? I mean, it's, like we said, yeah. It's like a super robot show that does take a lot of its influence from Kaiju and, like, Ultraman and stuff like that. So, like, man, those things are, like, rife with so courageous and very traditionally manly heroes, and he's definitely not that, as you put so well.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, and I'll be the first to admit, my experience with pre-90s anime, especially pre-90s mecha anime, is a little limited. The stuff that I've gotten to review for Anime News Network has really kind of expanded my knowledge a lot, but it's far from comprehensive.
Well, you reviewed Ideon, so you basically have seen... You've seen the... No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, no, totally well, kidding. No, that, I mean, so it's true. Like, with Space Runaway Ideon, you could see that the genre was kind of experimenting with different kinds of protagonists. You know, you'd have your classically heroic, successful heroes, or, you know, especially in the case of Ideon, you'd have characters that were maybe a little more flawed, a little more prone to failure. But I don't think I can point to an example of a show that just outright formed like the cornerstone of its whole plot. Is that our main character is a child that has no clue what the hell he's doing, and he's terrified, and he is not having a good time. You know, for 26 episodes, we're going to examine all of the ways that a pubescent boy should not be in charge of the fate of mankind because they can barely tie their shoes in the morning. And I think for a lot of people that go into science fiction, that go into anime, looking for characters like Luke Skywalker, that, yeah, they might start off kind of whiny, kind of unsure of themselves, but eventually they mature into the powerful, skilled hero that can kill the bad guy and save the day. I think that Shinji Ikari is in a lot of ways a direct challenge to that idea because, spoiler alert, he starts off the show as a scared, uncertain, ambivalent child, and he ends the show as pretty much the same thing, which isn't to say he doesn't have an arc. He has an amazing arc, but the show at no point tries to pretend that he's something that he's not. You know, the show doesn't, there's no grow a beard moment, at least in, or I guess I should say, at least in the original series. We'll get to the rebuild movies sometime, but in the original series, there really isn't a moment where Shinji fully enters into the classical role of the heroic figure. And I can definitely see why for a lot of people that is frustrating. But at the same time, I think you're right in that it's maybe not fair to take this incredibly complex, nuanced, and well-written figure that embodies a lot of the kind of emotional experiences of people that suffer from, you know, depression, anxiety, loneliness, and to just reduce him to a joke about not being able to pilot a giant robot. I mean, to be honest, would any of us do that much better in his situation? I don't know. If someone just came up to me on the street and said, hey, you got to pilot this robot. If you fail, everything you know and love is dead. Have fun. Yeah, I would also be a little freaked out.
Yeah, and especially, you know, if I had his family dynamics.
So I guess, you know what? Yeah, Father's Day was just recently, and I've seen a whole bunch of people online comment that Netflix had a golden opportunity to drop Evangelion on Father's Day. But yeah, you're right. It doesn't help that Shinji has one of the worst dads in the history of anime. Kind of the prototypical bad dad, right? Like, he's like the bad dad against which most bad dads are judged.
Indeed.
To the point where nowadays, if you want to be a bad dad, you have to like literally commit genocide while you're kicking a bunch of puppies in order to even get to the top tier rankings.
Gendo, bad dad gatekeeper.
Yeah, no kidding. We've talked a lot about kind of the original series impact on the industry. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to dive too much into the rebuild movies just because I kind of think those warrant discussions in and of themselves, mm-hmm. especially once we've kind of revisited the series. But just really quick, do you have a lot of experience with the rebuild films? Do you have a special amount of fondness or dislike for them at all?
So I have seen the first two.
Oh,
I have
okay.
not seen 3.33 yet.
that one's a doozy.
I've heard, yeah, that one's a complete departure, which honestly, I mean, I'm out there on the front lines of, you know, of standing for Evangelion. I love the original TV show, but we will always have that TV show. And whatever Hideaki Anno's reasons are for wanting to revisit this story, I'm fine with him doing his own thing again, doing a new thing, a new take on it. I don't think it existing is a problem. I have no issue with it. And, you know, even by the second movie, it departs quite a bit from the way the TV show goes, and I think it's interesting and it's fun, and I don't know if I will ever like hold them in like the same regard as the TV series, and that could be my own just nostalgia and things like that, like time and place talking, but I think that they look amazing, and they are again an extremely fascinating kind of experiment that I'm curious to see how it ends.
Yeah, and that's the thing for me is that, you know, I know that they're kind of supposed to ostensibly stand alone as their own entity outside of the original series, and maybe it's just because Evangelion was such a formative aspect of my entire childhood, of my media literacy, of my growth as a person, that I just can't separate it from the original. I have no problem with a show doing its own thing, to be honest. Like you said, I would rather it do its own thing than just be a really shiny beat for beat remake of the original show, because we already have the original show. And, you know, I feel like Anno's time and money would be better spent on other projects if he was just going to remake the show. But no, you're right. As far as the ending goes, where I feel the rebuild films are very much the first three parts of a four-part story. And especially with the third film, there just isn't a conclusion yet. And so so many of my thoughts on the rebuild films are going to really depend on how that last movie goes. I think the movies, like you said, are beautiful. I think they do some really interesting things with the story. I think some of the changes that they've made don't fall in line with what I would say is kind of the whole point of Evangelion. And we can talk about those, you know, more later on down the road. There's a lot of changes where I just don't know if they're going to amount to anything or not. You know, I just don't know if at the end of the day, when I see the whole picture, it's going to feel like its own cohesive thing, or if it's just going to remain, like you said, an interesting experiment. But the rebuild movies are out there. They are definitely, I think, more accessible, at least for the next few days they will be. We're recording this on the 18th. And so for the next 3 or 4 days, the rebuild of Evangelion movies are going to be the most accessible way to watch Evangelion. They don't really hold a candle to the original series, but I think they offer an interesting complement to them. They're very complementary.
Yeah, I think, like, sounds silly for me having not seen all of them, because I may feel differently later or someone else might feel differently. But me personally, I can't imagine being like, if I met someone who's like, oh, yeah, I've seen Evangelion, I've seen all the movies, I'd be like, no, I don't think you've really experienced the show, Evangelion, sort of in its most kind of distillated, pure, concentrated form.
Well, no, I mean, I think you're right on the money, and so much to the point. One of the things with 3.333, one of the things with the third rebuild film that I've found so difficult to wrestle with, right? Because to be perfectly frank, when I first saw 3.33, I was a little befuddled. Without giving too much away, since you haven't seen it, it departs from the source material almost entirely, to the point where the plot itself is in many ways unrecognizable. But at the same time, at least from where I stand, a lot of the choices that it makes, where the characters go, where the plot goes, a lot of them only really mean anything to me because I know how they're different from the original series.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I almost wonder, I would be curious, you know, hopefully we can get the opinion of someone who's like only seen the rebuild movies, what it would be like for them to watch that third movie and just go, oh yeah, this just must be what the story of Evangelion is, because it is nuts. That movie is nuts. It is bonkers. I love a lot of it, but again, it's like the first half. It's almost like Avengers Endgame. Not Avengers Endgame. It's like Avengers Infinity War, where you get to the end of that movie and it's this intense, exciting experience, but it's also not done. And, you know, for a lot of people, Avengers Endgame really kind of brought the story together and cemented it. So I guess I'm hoping that Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0, which is the real title that Hideaki Anno
is. Oh my God, is it really?
Yep. Yeah. It's well, no. So in Japanese, the title is Evangelion, and then it's the musical notation for repetition. Which I don't know how you would say that. And so the English title is Evangelion 3.0 plus 1.0.
So what you're saying is Evangelion is the prince of anime.
Yeah, a little bit. A little bit. But we'll talk more about Rebuild into the future. I would love to be able to cover those movies as well. At some point, once we've covered the show, but for
and this
now,
isn't even. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh no, keep going.
I was just gonna say this is not even to talk about the manga, which is also its own take, and you can't even sort of say like, oh, this is some alternate take on the story. This is because, you know, Sadamoto is as instrumental as anyone in making the original TV series what it was.
I know. And, you know, I'll be honest with you. I've only just recently come into possession of the entire manga series. I've read the first few volumes already. And so, you know, I'm a little familiar with how it deviates and how it doesn't. But you're right. I mean, you know, Sadamoto's voice and his style and his ideas are just as much a part of the DNA of Evangelion as Hideaki Anno's and all the other people that were responsible for producing the show. We'll probably talk about the manga at some point, especially once I finish it, because, you know, there are some instances where, you know, where that story goes, where the characters kind of end up.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're pretty neat. And yes. I don't necessarily think that they're worse than the show. I don't know if I'd say better, but I think they're just as valid. It's just as valid an interpretation of that story as the anime version in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's a wonderful compliment to have to it, I think.
Now, before we wrap things up, we'll probably want to talk about the actual Netflix release of the show.
What if no one talks about it? Wouldn't that be sad? You know, I don't think that's going to happen, but it just crossed my mind as we talk about it. Like, what if we're all preparing for an apocalypse, a take-ocalypse that doesn't occur?
Yeah, all these kids watch it and they're like, yeah, it's fine.
This is good. You know, it's all right. Like, I'm down with it.
The animation's kind of bad.
Right. Yeah.
I don't really like the ending, but, you know, a lot of anime don't have great endings. I'm not going to get it.
Of course, Twitter will be very understanding. Like, oh, no, of course, I can roll with it.
But so Netflix is, you know, they're the ones that reacquired the rights. It was a little bit of a kerfuffle because I know a lot of people assumed that it would go to Funimation, but Netflix, with their infinite vault of money that they have stashed somewhere, they threw enough of it at Gainax and Studio Kara to get those rights. And of course, now I know you were telling me that you weren't quite as keyed into this controversy, but I definitely saw how impassioned a lot of people got, because the big sort of piece of news about the re-release of Evangelion on Netflix is that for a multitude of complicated and boring legal reasons that essentially boil down to the original studio that did the English dub for Evangelion, ADV, is not out of it's not out of business, but it is essentially defunct. They barely release anything anymore, and the key players that worked at ADV have gone on to found their own much more successful distribution companies, but they still retain the rights to that original English dub, the one that starred Spike Spencer, Shinji, and Allison Keith as Masato, and oh my goodness, I just forgot the name of the actress that plays Asuka.
It's Tiffany.
Tiffany Grant. Right? Yes, yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Tiffany Grant is Asuka. She's my favorite character. Of course, I forget the woman that plays it. But no,
it always happens when you're recording.
Every time. But yeah, so Spike Spencer as Shinji, Allison Keith as Masato, Tiffany Grant as Asuka. You know, these are not only the performers that, you know, gave these characters their original English voices back in the early 2000s, but they also carried over to those Rebuild films when Funimation dubbed the Rebuild of Evangelion movies. A lot of the cast members had to be, you know, replaced and shuffled around, but the core kind of set of Shinji and Masato and Asuka stuck around. And so they've been playing these characters for decades. And a lot of people just naturally assumed that when it came time to re-record a dub for the TV series, that Spike Spencer and Allison Keith Shipp, as she's now known, and Tiffany Grant would just be part and parcel with the show. That, you know, there for a lot of people, and I will say kind of for myself, because the English dub was how I've always preferred to experience the show. You know, for a lot of people, those actors are kind of just as much a part of the Evangelion mm-hmm. experience as their Japanese counterparts. But long story short, Netflix, for whatever reason, decided to not recast Spencer and Keith and Grant in those roles. And from the way that the old performers discussed things on Twitter, it definitely seems like they were essentially kicked to the curb. Sidelined. They weren't really, they were brought into audition, but almost as like a kind of token, all right, we let you audition, but we never really had any intention of casting you kind of thing. And the internet being what it is, absolutely no one was mad about that at all. And no one ever talked about it again. No, the people were upset. And I, you know, I understand the just how difficult the politics of the acting business, even the voice acting business, can be. And so I'm not out here saying that people should, you know, be getting out their torches and pitchforks or anything. You know, don't harass anyone. Harassment is bad. Whoever they've gotten to recast these parts, I'm sure that they are going to be doing their absolute best. And they have a whole lot of pressure that I can only imagine that they're under. And they definitely do not need people on the internet yelling at them for decisions that were out of their hands. But I do want to ask, what are you, as far as this new dub is concerned, what are you anticipating? What are you expecting? Do you have any kind of hopes or fears as far as how they're going to approach the story and these characters?
If only, you know, if Jaden Smith plays Shinji, then I'll be
Are you proposing a full? Are you saying that in the first episode they're gonna be in a Neo Yokio 3?
That's right. And God, you know, his classmates will be played by Desus and Mero. It'll be great.
You are killing me. I think the podcast is canceled now. I think we just canceled the podcast. I think it's done. Thanks everyone for listening. Okay. Well, Jaden Smith is.
I'm going to add podcast killer to my Twitter bio.
Oh my goodness. Jaden Smith is.
This is a total joke. So what do I expect? Well, to address like the earlier things you said, I also think it's a shame in a lot of ways that the you know, the legacy cast didn't get to, you know, voice the new translation. So that would have been, I think, really a real treat for longtime fans. I guess, though, I mean, I don't know, maybe at the same time, the thinking is, well, we want to get a lot of new fans, so we need to have these new voices that maybe they recognize and gravitate to. I'm not sure, but I will definitely be intrigued, like, as to who that they've gotten to play these just incredibly memorable, I can't use the word iconic again, I'm looking for a different word, but like, yeah, these just like these super duper well-known and archetypical now in anime characters. I mean, this is going to be really fascinating for me to see. And I think that the performances, I expect them to be good. I you know, Netflix, obviously this was not a cheap acquisition, so I'm sure that they want it to be good. And I think it's probably not a controversial statement to say that, like, I probably in a lot of ways, like, the anime dubbing has gotten better over time.
I will be, as a ride or die defender of the original English dub, yes, it's corny, yes, it is a little hackneyed in spots, it's super cheesy, and that's partially why I love it. There are definitely things to improve. And as much as I am sad that, you know, those kind of classic roles are going to be maybe a little less familiar to me than I would personally and selfishly like, with these new actors. The dubbing industry has only become more reliable, I guess, in the past 20 years. The translations have gotten more accurate. I think the performers have been given a lot more opportunity to give those characters life in a way that maybe makes sense to Western sensibilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, something especially that I've noticed a lot in recent anime, especially like in a lot of the Sentai dubs and in some of the Netflix dubs, is I think that we're getting a lot better at letting the teenagers sound like teenagers. And I know that obviously none of the actors are going to be like real teenagers, but I guess I mean that, you know, even in those original roles, a lot of the cast members, you know, they sounded like anime characters in a way that made sense for 1997. But, you know, so much of the story kind of hinges on the characters being young and being inexperienced and being naive, that I think that there are a lot of ways that new performers could actually capture that in a way that maybe makes more sense for 2019. And I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward to maybe hearing a Shinji in English that actually sounds like a little kid and not so much like an actor playing a little kid, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I hate to dunk too much on Mr. Spencer there, but yeah,
don't listen to him, Spike. I'm here for you.
I agree. I think it'll be tough to outdo Tiffany Grant in some ways, because I just really love the way she talks. Like, I could just listen to her talk, and you know, and she plays to arguably the best character.
The fact that she also speaks German makes her voicing like a half German, half Japanese character actually work really well, because when she gets those lines in German in that original dub, if we're going to get like nitpicky, I really, really hope that they let Asuka speak German. And I really, really hope that whoever they got to play Asuka is able to deliver that German believably in the same way that Tiffany Grant was able to.
Yeah. 100%. And the other character that I am most worried about, now that we're talking about this, like you said, I hadn't been thinking about this very much, but oh boy, like Misato, she is my just most favorite, one of my most favorite characters in all of anime.
Drunk Mom.
I love her, and didn't always, but like, again, as Dad Doc, she's another character who I was like, oh man, like I am all about this character. I get you. You are incredible. And like, the person that plays her is going to have to like have a lot of range, because boy, she's, you know, she is, she's drunk and silly and flirty a lot, but she's also like a very believably put together, is she a colonel, I think, or a lieutenant? Like, she's in command
major,
of the war room.
Major Katsuragi, yeah.
That's right. So, but extremely competent and believable in that role, in that take charge, I'm in command sort of role. It's not cartoonish. It's really, like, just incredibly delivered. And then in her kind of motherly moments, too, and she has her you know, romantic subplot. So, like, there's going to be a lot of different attitudes and tones and things that the actor is going to need to nail. And boy, I am now really anxious about how my favorite character is going to come out in a way that I wasn't before we started.
Misato she's the perfect embodiment of the character that is a total badass and at the same time a complete mess. Yep. And the Japanese actors, obviously, and the original dub, you know, for all of its faults, it also, you know, Allison Keith Shipp was incredible at capturing, like I said, I mean, she's like that drunk mom who you think just has no idea how to adult, and then the minute the shit hits the fan, she is the one that is completely in charge, and she is the one that is, you know, getting things done. And yeah, she's, to steal your word, iconic. And I wish this new dub cast all of the luck, all of the support in the world, because not only are they kind of stepping into shoes that a lot of people might contend would be or should be filled by different performers, but they are also taking on one of the most iconic anime stories in the history of the medium. And so I deeply, deeply hope that all of you Evangelion fans, whether you're new or old, I hope you show them nothing but support and compassion, and that you recognize just how difficult what they're doing is, because I would not want to be the one to take on that mantle. It is it's a big one. So for as bitter as I might sound about the loss of some of my favorite performers, I want nothing but the best for this new cast, because you know it is it's an incredible opportunity, and I really hope and I really think that they are going to give it 110%.
Oh, for sure. Shoot, James, I forgot what I was going to say. Never mind.
Oh no,
we can move on. This is going to happen to me frequently. So,
does it have anything to do with the copious amount of butt shots that Misato gets in the show? Because,
not opposed to that. Can I just say, I'm let long may it continue.
Well, I was going to say, I did have, speaking of the new translation, I did have something, it's actually kind of popped up on the Anna Twitter discourse recently, and I was wanting to get your opinion on it. There's been some talk recently with Agretzko Season 2, and a lot of the anime that Netflix has been releasing, of how the translators, especially the in-house translators in Netflix, in my experience, they definitely seem comfortable with a kind of loose interpretation of the original Japanese, or I guess you could say they definitely take advantage of the artistic license to make those translations sound much more casual, I guess you could say, or much more amenable to what, you know, a Western Netflix audience might be expecting. And personally speaking, I'm actually all for that. I think that when translation is too rigid, when it's too kind of tied to the literal word for word, you know, transposing from Japanese to English, that can actually result in some pretty clunky dialogue. But I wanted to know, when it comes to that kind of loosey-goosey, liberal approach to Japanese to English translation, are you a fan of that? Do you think that that's kind of the approach that people should take?
Look, if you guys want a weird sounding, rigid, stilted Evangelion, just go play Xenogears.
That was harsh, but fair.
I love Xenogears.
Me
I
too,
love
Xenogears. But yeah, it's definitely, yeah, it's rough. It's rough going as far as that translation is concerned.
But you know, I guess I don't really have a super strong opinion. I mean, I think, like you were saying about voice actors, I mean, I think, like, translation, as someone who, like, for a couple of years in grad school, like, was a Latin translator part of the time, like, it's really hard.
That's interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, you better believe I've forgotten that. Like, because, you know, these things are, of course, like muscles. If you don't use them, they just go away. And I definitely hit a point in my life after grad school where I was like, guess who doesn't have time to do Latin? Me.
judging by all the books on my shelf, I would say 95% of civilization would agree with you there.
Right.
But like, zing.
Yeah.
Take that, Latin.
But like, it's tough. And so gosh, whatever, you know, style that translators like want to employ, like they have like good reasons for doing it. But I think if I had to like come down on it, like actually pick a side and be interesting and have a take, I would go with you that I think it's probably for the best if the dialogue sounds natural. If you had to, you know, if you have to choose between natural and accurate and you don't have both, you want to go with natural. Especially, you know, the goal, I think, of this new kind of rebirth of Evangelion on Netflix here is to, like, we want to get a bunch of new fans into our favorite thing, right? And so the best way to do that is to not have the dialogue be weird and clunky, and have it be something that is like as inclusive as possible and as natural and like that flows good in English as possible. So yeah, I think I'm with you. Read this.
It's so silly to me when people are yelling at translators for like changing some terminology or rephrasing something or especially replacing like Japanese idioms or maybe puns that just literally would not work into something that is a little more palatable for an English audience. Like, I mean, translating is an art. You know, people forget that. People forget that translating right. is more than just plugging something into Google Translate. Like, you really do have to make choices about what will communicate the fundamental meaning of what is being said the best. And so, you know, I don't know. Again, Netflix hasn't really released any details as far as to like who's working on this new translation or, you know, what their past credits might be. But my hope is that whoever is translating this new season is, you know, willing to deviate from that rigid one-for-one translation in order to make things sound natural. That's my personal take. I'm sure there are a lot of people that won't agree, and that's fine. But
yeah. You know how we used to in, you know, the fan sub days get copiously like super long like translator notes three quarters of the screen.
Yeah. Or when people just wouldn't translate a term for the sake of trying to sound like more authentically Japanese. Mm-hmm. Even like I get it. I get that you love the language and that you want to preserve as much of it as possible. But when you're trying to rope in, like you said, a whole new generation of fans that may be a more approachable translation.
I mean, in an ideal world, you know, we're not like constrained by the limits of any physical storage medium. So we can have, you know, a bunch of special features and little vignettes and stuff like that. And, ideally, more than just like, here's the trailer, which, you know, they have for every show on Netflix. Like, it'd be cool if there was like, you know, for really interesting or pivotal translation moments or things that they had to, you know, just kind of change because, like you said, this is an idiom or this is rooted in Japanese history in some sort of way that like it just can't be localized in a way that makes sense. Maybe there's like a 5-minute video and the translator's like, oh, we had to do this and this is what it means. That would be superb.
If physical media is dying, which I guess it is, or if at the very least a majority of the content we consume in these here future times is going to be streaming, let's get some bonus features, guys. I mean, bonus features are nice. People like those. And I'm with you, Doc. I think if we can get some making of, some behind the scenes, some commentary tracks, you remember those?
Oh, man.
Maybe not, because then we'd be out of business. But, you know, but something, you know, something to supplement that.
I'm tremendously excited to see it again and to watch it again with another person. Like, it's been, you know, since like the first couple times I watched it with another person, but in my like, you know, real grown up life, it's been kind of a solitary experience, and I've really like just honed in on it, like tried to absorb as much of it as possible and like be quiet, guys, my Ava's on, like leave me be. But it'll be cool to watch it with another person and just kind of just dissect sounds so not like what we want to do,
to experience it together, yes, to really have that
exactly
that mm-hmm. shared experience, that, you know, title drop, yeah. Right? That's really, and just to reiterate, I mean, that really is what I want this series within the kind of Kick the Beckett podcast label to be, is, you know, for us and for you, the listener, I really want it to just be a fun and communal way to experience the show, especially in this day and age when you don't always have an opportunity. It's kind of hard to like get a bunch of friends over to watch, you know, five episodes of a TV show. So hopefully, if nothing else, me and Doc and the other guests that will hopefully will be able to get along for this show will be there to make the experience of Evangelion maybe a little less solitary.
Absolutely. Boy, there's just so much that I can't wait, because I know I've forgotten so much because it's been, you know, just a handful of years since I've seen it. And
what you mean, you don't remember every single scene?
No, I don't
of the
remember
show,
every shot. Unfortunately, this is not the way my.
I thought you were a real fan.
This is my anxiety riddled brain does definitely like the anime slips through the cracks. Unfortunately, but yeah, I mean, there's going to be some new, some familiar. It's going to be a different way for me to experience it, and I am excited to interact with other people that are experiencing it, especially for the first time. I mean, I know that we're all dreading the bad takes, and you know that like the internet discourse is such that like there will be a hey guys, Ava is bad actually, like
a ton of this,
but like I think for every
Evangelion was never good and here are 10 reasons why, like
right. I think for every like 9 of those there will be like someone who was genuinely and positively affected by it that articulates that in a really new and beautiful way, and that makes all the bad takes worth it. And I'm excited to just be a part of this new wave of fandom.
Although I gotta say, if anyone comes out here with like a Darling in the Franxx is better than Evangelion piece, I'm probably going to have to quit the internet.
Oh, that might, man.
That might be my final straw. No ill will to you Darling in the Franxx fans out there, but anyone who has followed my writing for Anime News Network or my appearances on the Warrior Dish Show podcast, I have a very complicated relationship with that show. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that it's Evangelion, but without all the good stuff. But we'll get into that. We'll save that for later. For now, I think this is a good place for us to sign off, and we will be joining you guys again here very shortly for our official, our first podcast, which is going to be covering the first 4 episodes of the show. Each episode in the Experiencing Evangelion series is probably going to be between 3 and 4 episodes, just kind of depending on what feels natural. Look forward to those and for future updates. Thank you so much, Doc, for joining me on this adventure. I am incredibly excited. Now, just so people are aware, where can they find you? Where can they find your work?
So you can always find me at The Subtle Doctor on Twitter. And you can find my podcast, Warui Desho. The Twitter link is in my bio. That has its own Twitter account, and you can follow that for updates. But if you Google Warui Desho, like we're on YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts. You can follow us through the Twitter, anywhere like that. That's where you can find me lurking about online.
This is the Kick the Bucket podcast. This is our Experiencing Evangelion series, and I hope that you all join us for future episodes on this weird, wonderful, and wild journey. And we look forward to seeing you in the future. Thank you so much. And Doc, thank you for joining me, as always.
It was my pleasure.